Welcome to One in Messiah, and hello to everybody in YouTube land and Facebook land, and ultimately podcast land. But nice to be back on Friday night. Didn't meet last weekend because it was Good Friday and everybody had church services, and we went to three different ones at three different times, but that was cool. So since last Sunday was Resurrection Day, Easter Sunday, and because it was the day of the resurrection, it was also the Feast of First Fruits. So, like we said before, three of the spring feasts, Passover, Unleavened Bread, and First Fruits, were fulfilled by Yeshua in about 36 to 40 hours. Pretty cool. Only one more, and that's, of course, Pentecost, Shavuot. So now we're counting the Omer, we're counting the 50 days to get to Pentecost. So I don't know when it is on the calendar this year, but y'all can figure that out later. So today we're going to talk about resurrection and we're going to use John's account. So it's going to be from John 20, if you want to flip to it or click on it or whatever. In all the years we've been doing One in Messiah, which is now about seven, we've never done a resurrection talk because, you know, we meet the Friday before Good Friday, then we don't meet on Good Friday, and then the Friday after Easter, we usually do something else like 1 Corinthians 15 or something, May 28th. So sometime around there, we'll be doing Pentecost, depending what the closest Friday is. So tonight, I thought we'd talk about a little bit about the resurrection, because like Paul points out in 1 Corinthians 15, if you've never read 1 Corinthians 15, please go home and read it tonight for your homework. But Paul tells us, if there's no resurrection, then Jesus was not raised. And if Jesus was not raised, we're still in our sins. And not only are we still in our sins, but we're the most pathetic of all people. Why is that? Because we put our faith in a dead man. You know, any dead man then could be your savior if Jesus is still dead. So he says, if there's no resurrection, you're still in your sins. The resurrection was the ultimate sign of what he did, who he said he is, and how that's going to affect us both at the end of this physical life and ultimately when he comes back and wraps everything up and our bodies get rejoined with our souls, hopefully in heaven. You know, I heard a guy do a talk where he said, you know, when everybody's going to have a resurrected body at some point, it's going to join their soul. And for the people in heaven, it's going to be great because our body and soul are going to be reunited again. And the body and soul being separated is not normal. It's not how it was supposed to be because we're both things. We have the divine nature and we're also clay. You know, we worry more about our clay pots than our divine nature that's inside of us. But if when you're in heaven, you're going to enjoy heaven even more, if that's possible, when you have your body back. And on the other extreme, if you're in hell and you get your body back, the suffering's probably even going to be worse. I don't know. But I heard a guy do a talk on that. I thought it was kind of interesting. But we're going to go to John 20. If you happen to listen to my radio show last Sunday, I did the Luke 24 account. This year I was really into doing resurrection stuff. So I thought we'd do John's account. You know, they're a little different. Same characters, little slight differences in sequence. But first of all, we have to say, what do we mean by the resurrection? You know, Jesus, Yeshua, did not come out of the grave as a cosmic force or as a spirit or as of some non-corporeal, you know, light. He came out of the grave with his human body. And it's the same body that was conceived in the womb of the Virgin Mary, developed, was born, grew, was fed, had to be fed, had to learn how to walk, had to learn how to talk, got tired, he had to eat, he had to drink water, he had to go to the bathroom. He had all the normal body functions that we have. And that same body grew up through childhood, through teenage years, young man working in the wood shop. When he got splinters in his fingers, it hurt. If he cut himself with a saw, it hurt. It wasn't a cosmic projection. It's a real human body. I don't like to say was a real human body because he has his body and we're going to see it. And as that song, Monica Pimer, I can't remember the name of the song now, about how I'm going to see the hands that took the nails for me one of these days. But anyway, you can Google that later. So that same body came out of the tomb, was seen by people. He sat and ate some fish with those guys. You know, he came in the upper room and said, "You guys got anything to eat?" They said, "Well, we got some leftover pizza from a few days ago." No, they got some fish. He ate the fish. The same body that stood on the beach and made them all breakfast. And the same body that from the Mount of Olives ascended into heaven. And when he comes back at the end, it's going to be, when he comes back, it's going to be the same body. So the resurrection of the body means this is his physical body. This is the body of Jesus of Nazareth. Divine Jesus always existed. There was not a time where he did not exist. We know, you know, we won't mention names, but people who come to your door don't believe that. They feel that Jesus was created. He was, you know, first being created, then he became kind of a junior partner and the rest of the creation. But no, he is the Godhead. He gave the law to Moses. He's the creator. Nothing, Paul tells us, nothing was made that wasn't made. Everything was made by him, through him, and for him. And so it's important to understand that the Messiah is the God-man, gave his life for us in his humanity, because of course divine Jesus didn't die. Physical Jesus died. If you would have walked by that cross when they were taking the body down, you would have said, "Whoa, this is a dead man. I mean, look how horrible he looks. He's been brutalized and he's dead." You'd have seen them put him in the grave and you'd have walked away saying, "Oh man, that's horrible. We heard him teaching. We saw him up in Galilee once do a miracle, and he's dead." You know, you probably heard of the swoon theory where he kind of went into a coma and revived himself and, you know, moved this big stone out of the way and came out. But anyway, so this is very important. So we start. We're not going to read all the scripture, but now the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw the stone had been taken away from the tomb. Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, that's of course John, and said to them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Now, Mary Magdalene was with him a long time, right? 3 years in Galilee, to Jerusalem, heard all his teachings, was probably there when he raised Lazarus. He said to all these guys, "I'm going to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to be delivered into the hands of evil men. I'm going to be put to death. On the third day, I'm going to rise." What was Mary Magdalene going to do that morning? Anoint the dead guy. She didn't say, "I'm going to go to the tomb because I know he's risen. I just want to go see there's an empty tomb." No, she had a little bucket of aloes and myrrh. She's going to finish the burial custom. Luke describes this, you know, these women went. They were going to finish anointing the body. put him back in, find somebody to put the stone. You know, they're wondering who's going to move the stone. So she sees the stone. She goes and gets Peter and John. In Luke's account, Peter and John say, this sounds like a fable. This can't possibly be true. The angel says to Mary Magdalene, remember he told you. It says, and then she remembered. Peter and John said, oh, this sounds like a fable. They run to the tomb, and then they remembered. And we probably would have done the same thing. These guys had been through a pretty traumatic last 3 or 4 days. They had seen him dead, seen him put in the tomb. And now realize he's not in the tomb, realize he's alive, physically alive. So the tomb is empty. Mary doesn't understand this yet. Doesn't get what's happened here. Peter and John don't get what's happened here. She's going to anoint the body. She's worried about the Jewish burial customs. You know, it'd be kind of us saying, well, you know, Uncle Joe died and he's at the ABC funeral home, and then they're going to take him to the XYZ cemetery and they're going to bury him, and you know, we're going to have a memorial service, you know, kind of like all the customs everybody does. And if there's a snowstorm or something and they can't bury Uncle Joe for 3 or 4 days, everybody gets nervous. It's just, you know, we got to do the burial custom. These women were going to the tomb because they were worried about the burial custom. Because you remember on Good Friday, they had to do it really fast because it was almost Shabbat. And they weren't, I mean, they were defiled anyway touching a dead body. But they weren't going to have a dead body out during the Sabbath. The other guys got taken down from the cross too. So they went for the burial customs. Then she runs to Peter and John. Peter, therefore, went out and the other disciple and were going to the tomb. So they both ran together. The other disciple outran Peter and came to the tomb first. And he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen cloths lying there, yet he did not go in. John beats him there because he was younger. You know, some people say he was 16, 17 years old, so he could run faster than Peter. He got to the tomb. He didn't go in. He just looked inside. Then Simon Peter came following him, went into the tomb, and he saw the linen cloths lying there and the handkerchief that had been around his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded together in a place by itself. Burial cloths. The part that covered his face and head was folded neatly and put there. Now, if Jesus hadn't been really dead and he kind of revived himself, would he say, wait, I got to fold this up first before I go out? And then, even though I'm totally dehydrated and I have no circulation and I've been barely breathing, I got to push this big rock out of the way. No, the reason the head cloth was folded, some of you may know, is this was a sign that the work was done. If somebody came to work at your house, somebody came to do some work outside your house, you know, they always had their heads covered because of the sun. And when they were done with their work, they would take the cloth, they would fold it neatly into a square, and they would put it down by your door. That meant the work was over. The work that they were doing was finished. If you were having a dinner and you had servants, which, you know, was not many people had servants, but if you had servants and you got up to answer the phone or somebody was at the door or you went to turn the TV off, where's Jordan? I mean, if you got up to leave the table and you were coming back, you just left your napkin there. If you were done eating, you folded your napkin into a square and you put it down on the dish or on the table. And that told the servant you were done eating. So when Peter sees the headpiece folded, he knows what this means. The work is over. The work is done. Because the work of salvation was done. Not only because sin was conquered by the blood, but because death was conquered, because he died and then came back to life. So death is conquered, sin is conquered. Woo! The law can't do that. The laws never revived anybody. So they ran to see for themselves. You know, Peter's bold, so he goes right in. And you got to love Peter. He's got a big mouth. He's a, you know, big, strong, working guy. I think the guy who plays Peter on The Chosen is not how I ever pictured Peter. I mean, he's kind of too young, and I picture the Peter as being kind of older, been a hardworking guy, you know, kind of muscular and what we used to call salty, you know, in his language and stuff, like a sailor. But Peter's bold. He goes in, he sees the cloths, and he realizes he's risen. He realizes that death has been conquered. He's not a theologian. He doesn't say, oh, now, let me see. Let's examine the possibilities here. He remembers now Jesus saying, I'm going to die. Third day, I'm going to rise. He's risen. He's left a sign here with the head thing being folded. The work is over. Sin's been conquered. Death's been conquered. So no fear of the grave. Nobody likes graves. Nobody likes cemeteries. Nobody wants to, you know, think about dying. But it's part of life. And it's the gateway to the next life. So we should not have fear of the grave. You know, Paul says our death isn't meaningless like the pagans. Because we can know where we're going. Our death is not meaningless. Sure, it's hard for the people that are grieving for you and, you know, miss you and so forth. But we shouldn't have the hopelessness of it, because we shouldn't have fear of the grave, because he left his burial clause behind, and no matter what they bury us in, you know, I want to have a pine box, and I don't care what they dress me in. But, you know, if I'm in a really fancy casket and have a really nice suit on, it's not going to matter, right? Or if I'm buried like this in a pine box, or, you know, if I have my jeans and my IDF t-shirt, it's not going to matter, because your grave clothes don't matter. They're going to decompose just like your body's going to decompose. Because when he came out of the tomb, he left his burial clothes behind. When we come out of the tomb, we're going to leave our burial clothes behind. He has heavenly robes on, white, shiny. They got a picture of this at the Transfiguration, but now he's always got those white robes on. When he comes back, those white robes are going to be stained with blood. But anyway, that's a topic for a different talk. But he's got heavenly robes on now. Lazarus came out of the grave with his grave clothes still on. Remember? Jesus says to the sister, untie him. Get the burial clothes off of him. You know, Lazarus comes walking out. He's still like all wrapped up in linen. Didn't leave the grave clothes behind. He was going to need them again, so to speak, because he was going to die again physically. I don't think anybody, I've never read anything about what happened to Lazarus. He's never mentioned again in the scriptures. I've never read any kind of historical accounts. I don't know if any of you guys have. But we know one thing for sure. At some point he died again. And they buried him again. Maybe in the same thing. And maybe, you know, if he was on his deathbed and was conscious, he's thinking, well, here we go again. Been through this one. So he came out with his grave clothes on. He was going to need those grave clothes again. Yeshua, Jesus, doesn't need his grave clothes again. They stayed in the tomb. And we're not going to need them. And we get this third day thing. You know, there's third days mentioned by him quite a few times. But it's even mentioned in the prophet Hosea, one of the minor prophets. A great book if you've ever read it. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up that we may live in his sight. So third day, he's going to rise up. This is when the ancient creeds said, rose from the dead on the third day according to the scriptures. It comes from here. third day he would rise up. It's a messianic prophecy that people didn't realize was a messianic prophecy. Because remember in Jewish thought, they felt that the body began to decompose on the fourth day. Fourth day. This is why he waited till the fourth day after Lazarus died to get to where Lazarus was. Because he wanted to leave no doubt in anybody's mind Lazarus was dead. In fact, his sister said, oh man, if we move the stone, there's going to be a stench. And then in one of the Psalms, and now I can't remember which one it was, it says, you know, you will not allow your Holy One to undergo corruption. So Jesus has to rise on the third day because he's not going to undergo corruption. His body's not going to just be left someplace to rot. It physically comes out of the grave on the third day, which was really, might be less than 48 hours it was in there. Probably quite a bit less, but it counts as the third day. Now, but Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping. And as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet where the body of Jesus had lain. Then they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" Luke accounts two angels tell her, hey, he's not here. Remember, he told you. Here she looks in the tomb, two angels. Why are you crying? Now, they're in white. They're shiny. They're sitting there. One at the head, one at the feet. It's kind of like, here's Mary weeping at the tomb. There's angels come to announce he's risen. Just like angels came to announce he was born. This is not as dramatic as the glory filling the skies and, you know, singing jingle bells. Oh, no, that wasn't jingle bells. Where's Jordan? You know, singing the Son of David had been born. But there's angels announcing the Messiah's risen. He's not here. Just like there were angels at his birth. Because these guys are messengers. They came from heaven just for this purpose. I mean, just for this purpose, these two angels came. Just to tell Mary Magdalene what had happened. Two witnesses. Important because Torah. Two or three witnesses. If you commit a crime and one guy comes forward and says, yeah, I saw him do it, and nobody else, not guilty. But if two people come forward, three people come forward and say, yes, we saw him do it, that's what you need. So here, two messengers come, two witnesses come to proclaim that Jesus has risen. He's not in this tomb. And notice there's an angel at the head and there's an angel at the feet. I never thought about that before. But it kind of reminds you of something. The Ark of the Covenant that had the two seraphim, right? I think it's seraphim and cherubim. Seraphim, one at one side, one at the other side, and their wings were just touching. So there was one at the head, one at the feet, just like the Ark. You know how he said, one greater than the temple is here? Yes. One greater than Jonah is here? Yep. One greater than Solomon is here? Yep. Well, one greater than the Ark is here. And so these angels looked like the angels on top of the ark, or kind of represented it. How cool is that? I never thought about that before. And now when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Many people feel this is a troublesome passage because she doesn't recognize him. So, two comments on that. One is, she's looking in a tomb. She's looking at two guys that are shining white, and they're telling her unbelievable news. He comes up behind her, and she's like, You know, who are you? She thought, you know, he was the landscape. He was the guy from Chemlon who was there, you know, working in the garden. Then, you know, she's confused. And the other part of this explanation that you probably have heard is this glorified body looked a little different than his regular body. Like when I get my glorified body, I like to think that I'll have hair. And then if I'm walking around in heaven, none of you guys, except Bruce and Keith, will recognize me because then they'll have hair too. Where's Jordan? So your glorified body is going to look a little bit different. You know, like if you die when you're two, is your glorified body going to look like if you die if you're 102? I don't know. Nobody knows. I don't think you're going to have the body of a 2-year-old, and I don't think you're going to have a body of a 102-year-old. I don't know what you're going to look like, but your glorified body looks a little different than the body that you know here, and in some cases, that's a good thing. Oh, come on, this is a tough crowd. Jeez. We've had too many satyrs. That's the problem. So she wants to know where he is. Has anybody ever studied the Song of Songs? The bride is looking all the, you know, for a couple periods of time, her beloved, the Lord, the groom, goes away from her. He's not really gone, but she doesn't realize that he's there. And she walks around saying, "Where is my beloved? Where's the one I love? Where's the one who loves me?" You know, you get kind of like that dark night of the soul kind of thing that different mystics and fathers of the church used to talk about. You get a time where you're kind of discouraged and you don't know what's going on, and you start to feel like, has God abandoned me? Maybe I'm just like, so it's just like, where is he? I'm looking for him and he isn't here. I don't know where he is. She's been seeking him, but then he comes to her, just like in the Song of Songs. The groom comes to the bride, to the Shulamite. She's looking for him, running through the city, going, "Has anybody seen my beloved? I don't know where he is." She lies on the bed saying, "Where is he? I don't know. He's left me. I don't know where he is." But then he comes. He comes to be with her. He comes to find her because he's always near to those who have a broken heart and saves such as has a contrite spirit, Psalm 34. He's always there. You know, you've probably seen the old picture of the footsteps in the sand, and there's two sets of footprints, and then for a while there's only one, then there's two again. And I says, "How come?" "Well, you know, at that point I had to pick you up and carry you for a while, and then you were okay." So he's always there, but she's looking for him. He comes to her. Jesus said to her, "Mary." Remember when he called Lazarus, Lazarus came out. If he would have just said, "Come out," every dead person on that mountain would have come out. But he called Lazarus by name. Here he says, "Mary." He doesn't say, "Mary, Mary," which would have been kind of a scolding. He could have said, "Mary, Mary, don't you remember I told you?" No, it's a tender thing. He just says, "Mary." And then she immediately knows that it's him. Remember in Hebrew, if you repeat somebody's name, you're really trying to get their attention and telling them, "Listen to what I'm telling you." Like when Jesus says, "Martha, Martha," you know, at the burning bush, God says, "Moses, Moses." Here he just says, "Mary." She turned and said to him, "Rabboni," which is to say, "teacher." Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father. And to my God and your God." He has a message for the brethren. What does he call them? Brethren. He doesn't say those guys. He doesn't say, "Yeah, go tell. Don't think I forgot that Peter denied me 3 times. Don't think I've forgotten about that. Don't think I don't know they're hiding because they're scared. And I know they've been up there in that room and they're afraid to even look out the window." No, he says, "Go tell my brethren what's happened." You know, in the book of Hebrews, it says he's not ashamed to call us brethren. Now, if you're descended from Abraham, you're a closer brother than those of us that are just brothers because both he and I are both descended from Adam and Eve. He and all of us are descended from Adam and Eve. So he calls them brethren. And I'm going to my father and your father, my God and your God. Same father, same God. That's where I'm going. So he calls her by name. In the Song of Songs, this is what the bride hears. She hears the groom call her by name. And she goes, oh, my beloved is back. So as soon as he says her name, she's on it. And they even use the word Rabboni, which is a great teacher. I forgot what the Greek word that's used here is, but it's a great teacher, a great master. It's somebody who's really, you really treat with honor and respect because of how much they've taught you. You know, before they had to do away with the Hippocratic Oath, because doctors violate it 50 times a day, every day now, there was a part in it that I really used to like, and it was about honoring the men, because in those days, of course, it was all men. You honored the men who taught you medicine. You always held them with respect and admiration. And the oath even says, if they die and they should have minor children, you're supposed to raise their children as your own. Really cool. So, you know, it was kind of like, well, I don't want to get into a whole long story, but, you know, like even the professors in medical school, 30 years after you graduate, you still call them Dr. So-and-so. Just like when you meet your high school English teacher, you don't say, hey, Jack, you know, how you doing? You say, oh, Mr. Wow, great to see you, because you have respect and admiration for them. And so it's honor and respect to call him Rabboni. So now Mary's forgotten about the angels. You know, she's just having a conversation with the angels, but now she knows she's with him. Who cares about the angels anymore? Now you're with the Creator. Now you're with the one who holds everything in the universe together. Colossians chapter 1 holds everything together. Hank Hanegraaff says there's not a maverick molecule anywhere in the universe that he doesn't know, you know, where it is and what it's doing. So she's with him now. She forgot about the angels. And he announces he's going to be leaving. Wait a minute. I just found you again. But he announces he's going to be leaving because he's not here to start a temporal kingdom. He's not here to go to Jerusalem now and say, okay, I'm king of Israel, because I am. I'm king of Israel. I'm going to vaporize all these Gentiles that are here. Peter over here is going to be my prime minister. All these guys are going to have good government jobs. They're going to be the cabinet. We're going to run the government from here. No, he says, it's not, my kingdom is not of this world. It's not a temporal kingdom. I'm going to be leaving. And remember, before this in John, he said, it's going to be good for you that I'm leaving. Because then the paraclete can come. And that's going to be even better for you than having me here. Which, of course, was kind of hard to believe in, is, you know. So now there's a different relationship, Mary and my brethren. You're not going to be following me around, walking around in Galilee. We're not going to be going to Denny's anymore and have Judas pay the check. Judas is dead, by the way. We're not going to go to some deli and wait an hour till you all decide what you want to eat. It's not going to be like that anymore. We have a different relationship now. And so he says his father and our father, his God and our God, were adopted into the family now. It's Abba. It's Daddy. We're adopted into the family. We're not slaves working in the kitchen. We have a place at the table where we sit. We're adopted sons and daughters. You go from being an outcast. You go from being unclean. You go from being defective. You go from being guilty, which we are all those things, to being an adopted son or daughter. Romans 8:15. For you did not receive the spirit of bondage, again, to fear, but you received the spirit of adoption, by whom we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself, who? The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs. And heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. We have adoption now. Different relationship. It's not the God with the scorecard anymore. Going, oh, tough luck, bub. You know, the bad things outweigh the good. Not by much, but sorry. Different relationship now. Spirit of adoption. There's nothing in Torah, nothing in all of the Tanakh where God says, just call me daddy. Now we're adopted. We're in the family. And Paul points out we're co-heirs. Because, let's face it, under law, and it was their law too at that time, and our law now, if I have a natural son and an adopted son, and my wife and I suddenly die, each of the sons, each of those two boys is considered my son. Right? Even though one's biological, one's not. Because by law, the adopted son is your son. So they become co-heirs. Co-heirs. So here's your money, your credit card debt, your and whatever else. But you're co-heirs. And Paul says we're co-heirs with Christ. He's the real son. We're the adopted son or daughter. So if you're a co-heir, what does that mean? You inherit what he inherits, which is what? Everything. So Paul says we'll be judging angels. The angels can't understand this. You know, Peter writes, the angels want to look into these things because they can't understand it. Why should we be so special compared to what they've been doing all this time? You know, they look down at people and say, geez, they get old, they're weak, they're sick, they're always rebelling. Why should they have any of this? But we have the spirit of adoption. And because of the resurrection, you know that it's true. It's the ultimate sign. You talk about signs and wonders. It's the ultimate sign. Woo. So that's John's account. If you want Luke's account, check out last week's radio show on the Gift of Grace site. Or I think it's on the podcast too, but I can't remember yet. Awesome.